So the question was asked, how are we to understand that when we look at the world, we don't necessarily understand a system? We see, and I want to sharpen the question, as we discussed, and if you want, we have this discussion under a few titles, but what I'm going to say now is the commentary on the Ein Yaakov, in our Ein Yaakov class in Brachos, that what Moshe Rabbeinu was asking God was, how come some of the just have it good and some of the just have it bad, and some of the wicked have it good and some of the wicked have it bad? Meaning, if you'd say all the wicked have it good because let them eat up all their goodies from the world to come, which is what some people answer, so I understand, I see a system at least. You're evil, you have it good. Okay, I see a system. You're righteous, you have it bad, but I don't see no system. Some righteous have it good, some righteous have it bad, some wicked have it good, some wicked have it bad. So now I don't see a system. So that's what Moshe Rabbeinu says to God. I look at the world and I don't see a system. Now, we have to understand that on this question, there are a few different answers. There's a whole book of Job, which you're welcome to check online on 123torah.org. We learned that whole book, even though it deserves more depth than that setting allowed. And it was a setting of like a 7-minute class, so we went incrementally. But and the book of Habakkuk addresses that question. And other sources as well, and obviously in philosophy and in Talmud. And so whatever we're going to say is one angle. And here, in general, I have an introduction. And there are a few points to introduce whenever we talk about Jewish thought. Number one is, I'm one person, and you're one person, and you're one person, and each of you are one person. Tonight, before we left the Kotel, I wanted to take you guys over to the walls of the Kotel and ask you, how old do you think those stones are? Give them an age. How long do you think they're standing on that wall? They're young stones, the one we see, right? They're only there about 2,000 years, right? Or less, even. Maybe 1,800, 1,700. They're young stones. You go deeper down, you'll see stones that are there beyond that, right? So if you're talking about something that's far older than we are, right? Let's have a little bit of respect. I'm a Mohel, so a friend of mine told me the following story. He was at a circumcision where someone not too professional messed up. And the kid's bleeding all over, and it happened in Kiryat Arba. And so the paramedic who told me the story grabbed the kid and held him so that to hold the bleeding. And they took him to the hospital. And when they got to the hospital, so it's really not such a big deal to stop the bleeding, you know, but the guy who did it decided to make a big deal out of it. And he started cursing out, oh, you're ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta customs. And the paramedic who saved the kid's life looked at him and said, this custom is a little bit older than you. As a matter of fact, it's much older than you. Just shut up and do your work. I'm quoting the paramedic. We have to realize that we're approaching something which, whether you accept it being God's wisdom or not, it's wisdom that's been developed over a number of millennia. In one night, we're not exactly going to get it all. And in one day or one week or one month, you're studying something, realize that it's big. If those stones have been here for 2 millennia in the shape you see them, so then this system has been questioned and attacked, and on all angles it's had to contend with the Greek philosophy, the Roman philosophy, and every philosophy ever since, and it's still here. And they weren't dumb people. So we're going to try to understand it. If you walk away and you tell yourself, he didn't answer my questions, that's legitimate. Go continue searching. It could be I did answer the question, and from a person's vantage point, a person's maturity, a person's state in life, he doesn't understand the answer, or the answer doesn't resonate with him. And it could be I'm not smart enough. I definitely am not smart enough. There are many answers out there that I don't yet know, but I can present from my angle. I will try to be honest, and when I don't think something holds water, I'm not going to present. And I've said that in numerous classes, including when we encounter proofs, as we discussed from the Kuzari, or in other classes we discussed from Maimonides, where I say, you know, I don't really understand why that's a good proof. So I'm going to try to be honest. But these are few introductions, and a person has to outgrow the teenage stage, which says, if I have a question and you didn't answer it tonight, then that's it. This is like a goodbye. No, you know, things are a little bit more complex than that. Okay, with all those introductions, now let's begin. So, before we attack the question of why, we have to address the question of what. And after we've addressed the question of what, then we have to ask ourselves how important is the question of why. I'll explain. At the conclusion of the book of Job, so God appears to Job, and God gives him an answer why he suffered. And Job turns back to God and says, God says, you understand now? So Job says, no. But I can live with it. What changed? Why was it that throughout the book he couldn't live with it, and at the end of the book he could live with it? Because if I understand what, if I understand that God exists, and he created the world, and he knows what's going on here, so if I can figure all that out, so then the fact that I can't figure him out, if I can't figure out his system, so then I might have to live with that question. Now, the great challenge in life is, firstly, to figure out what. And secondly, after I figured out what, not to let the questions of why trick me into going back on what I figured out. So the greatest example of this is Avram Avinu. God gives Avram Avinu prophecy, right? Should be pretty clear there is a God. And yet, God tells him, your future is Isaac. Yeah, clear, black and white. And then God tells him, go sacrifice him. Now, if you'd ask Avram Avinu, what's God thinking? Didn't he just contradict himself? Avram Avinu does not have an answer. Again, you meet Avram en route to the binding and ask him, Abraham, explain this to me. How could you believe in this? How? Wait. He asked me how I could believe in it. I could explain to you all the logic of why God exists. He said, I have to do. But wait a second, but he's contradicting himself. Do you understand him? No, I don't. So now Avram has a tremendous temptation. If what he's doing and what he's saying goes so much against my grain, hey, wait a second, I don't understand him. So then I'm very tempted to deny him. And we have to be very honest intellectually on these two halves of the question. The first question is, does he exist? Did he create the world? Did he give us a Torah? Am I obligated to him? Now, a person can say, he exists, he created the world, he gave the Torah, and I don't understand him. Not only can say that, if he's honest, he will say that. And now, we'll go the other way. Most people, most of the time, have tricked themselves. They don't want to recognize that deep down inside, they're always contending with the question, is he really there? And the reason they're contending with that question is because they haven't separated between the why and the what. And we have many questions when it comes to why. Why did he do A and B and C and D? And you have a slew of questions. But do they really contradict the what? If you've taken the time to build and understand that there is a creator and he has demands and he gave us a Torah, then the why does not contradict the what. They're two separate questions. I might not like living in a world where I don't understand the why. So then I can spend my life searching for the answer, and as I grow, I will understand more. But those are two separate questions. You with me so far?
I was thinking about something that a man told me. He used to be very religious. He said that after the Holocaust, he said that he knew many families who were not religious that became religious, and he knew even more that, or not even more, but probably maybe an equal amount of religious people that became anti-religious. And the way that they thought was that something had happened so badly to them that whatever way they were living before must have been wrong, so they just switched. So, I love that verse that I had mentioned. I'm sorry, did you?
I thought you might be there.
It just seems like Solomon, the wisest man in the world at the time, had reflected and he tried everything that was available for him at the time, and he just said, it's random. We're just living in a random place, and what can I say? It seemed to me that's what he was saying, or maybe it was David. I don't know. I wasn't really prepared. I had some really good anecdotes I could have brought up that demonstrate what I'm saying, but as I'm a terrible speaker, I hate talking in front of people.
That's what I saw, so I feel it's not fair to put you on the spot. So going back to, so we could talk one-on-one. I also think that what I just told you is the product of many works and is a part of a series I have online called, what's it called? I showed it to you.
1-2-3-4.
On that website, I think it's like Basics Jewish Thought. We have 8 classes, so it's part of a system. Meaning, I think you have to think about it and then see, wait a second, does that make sense to me? Now, going on to the question of a child who's an orphan having cancer. A child who's an orphan suffering. He didn't do anything to deserve it. Come on, the kid's 1-year-old, 2-year-old. He didn't do anything. I think that once we have this approach, one of the things we have to be careful about is our constricting God to our system. We're very tempted to capture God, put him in a genie bottle. So people look for amulets, and people look for codes, and people look for systems. And there's a special segula, there's a special amulet, that whenever you try to corner God, he shows you you didn't have him cornered. There is no system that an individual can take and say, perfect, that's it, I know, I learn Torah, I make money, I give tzedakah, I make money, I know everything just works. Because if there were a system for the individual to just do it right and that's it, everything's going to go right, he'll have health, he'll have wealth, he'll have everything, then life wouldn't be a challenge. And the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Ein biyadeinu, we don't have a good answer to the question, Mishal vata rishaim, why is it that wicked have it peacefully, ve'af lo miyisurei tzadikim, nor why the righteous suffer. So all the answers you're going to give me, well, right, there are those that give certain answers. According to Maimonides, there are different opinions among the sages about whether we have an answer to the question or don't have an answer to the question. But there's at least one opinion in the Talmud that says, we don't have a good answer. Now, sometimes, and that's what I was trying to explain earlier, sometimes our answers are not 100%. Our answers are, what should be my attitude? How can I, as a human being, contend with the challenges that this poses before me? So I say to myself, wait a second, this isn't really going to answer the question, but it's an attitude that's in line with the Torah. And sometimes the Midrashim or Chazal themselves give us an attitude, which is a formula with which you can work in this world. But that doesn't mean that that answers the question at square one, which leads us to a much broader question. Anytime you're going to discuss God, you're not answering questions, because you're always going to come back to the question, why? You know, that's the famous story of my 3-year-old, my 2-year-old. I was walking with the 2-year-old in the street, and the 3-year-old says, Abba, I want to go in the street. And I say, don't go in the street, it's dangerous. Why? Because there are cars in the street. Why? Because people have to get places. Why? Because they have to get to work. Why? Because they have to make a living. Why? You know, kids hit this age where they always ask you why. Because they have to buy food. Why? Because they have to eat. Why? Because they have to live. Why? Because that's how Hashem created the world. Okay, 2 seconds later, Abba, can I eat that? He sees a little thing on the floor. No. Why? Because it's not healthy. It's why? At the end of the day, that's how Hashem created the world. And now the kid doesn't end there. The kid keeps going, why? You know, why did Hashem create the world that way? And you're going to say, because he wanted to. And he's going to say, why? You know, kids reach that age where they keep asking. So at the end of the day, every question ends up with, that's how Hashem created the world. Why? Because he wanted to. Why? You don't have an answer. Anything under the sun, you're going to end up there. So all our answers start at step three. Hashem created the world because he wanted to. And I don't know why. I don't know why he created the world. I don't know why he wanted that. But at step three, from my perspective, the way I could deal with the world is he wanted to do good to me, or whatever answers you're going to give about why Hashem created the world. But it's not really at the root of the matter. At the root of the matter, you didn't answer the question. Now, I reserve the right, as we grow in learning, Bezrat Hashem, in a number of years, to modify what I just said. But at our stage of the game, I think that's the correct approach.
So you have two sides of the coin. When you have a child coming to you and saying, Abba, you believe in Hashem and you believe everything's for a reason, why am I sick? So what do you say? Do you say their number? You can say it's something your parents did?
No.
Do you say it's something that is to make you strengthen you, test for you, something your previous life is with it? What do you...
I'm just bothered because a year ago, someone came to me that his niece was diagnosed with cancer, a kid, and we were going to sit down and write a pamphlet of how should a Jew who's going to represent Orthodox Judaism help a child contend with a terrible illness. How am I supposed to understand this? What am I supposed to do with this now? And I just feel bad because we never got to do it. That's why I'm... So I think there are a few things, a few do's and a few don'ts. Let's begin with the don'ts. Don't say it's because I sinned. You don't know that. And that's a horrible way to approach things. I'm suffering because my Abba did something wrong. No, that's a don't. Don't say it's because the kid sinned. Okay, what are the do's? So you could say, depending on where a child's holding, that we don't understand what Hashem does, and children connect with honesty. You could tell the child that we all have challenges and we don't get to pick them. And what we do get, and this is now a whole philosophy we're going to say in one sentence, but in all of life, there's stimuli and response, right? All of life is composed of stimuli and response. The human being is defined by the moment between stimuli and response. There is that moment in between where you decide what the response is going to be. He smacks you, what do you, you'll say, I smack him back. Wait, that moment in between stimuli and response, that's what defines who you are. Now, we don't get to choose the stimuli very often. You don't choose who hits you, and you don't choose what illness the person has, but you do choose your response to it. I was just thinking tonight, 2 years ago, you remember Issa? We had a student here who, and that's, if we'll ever get to your question, I have a phenomenal story to tell you there, who had a very, very difficult disease. And he came to class once when things were complicated, and I told him the following story. There was a woman who lived a few houses from the Machon, whose two parents died from cancer, and she was diagnosed with cancer. And she had a bunch of little kids at home. I remember her little one wasn't toilet trained. And the doctors gave her less than 6 months to live. And it was true, she passed away in under 6 months. She passed away like clockwork when the doctor said she would. You know all those stories where people outlive the doctor's prognosis? Okay. Those stories where the doctors actually get it right. And she had a form of cancer that they have no cure for. And she was in the hospital getting whatever treatment could prolong her life. And she had one bad leg. So she had a scooter, and she'd put her bad leg on the scooter, and she'd pedal around with her other leg to visit other patients and make them happy. and she'd join the hospital clown, the medicinal clown, and she'd help him shape up his act, and she'd go around the hospital making people happy, and she's in the oncology ward, and there's a guy sitting there all bald because of the chemo and all worn and down, and she's trying to make him happy together with the medicinal clown, and he goes to her, "Lady, of course you could be happy. You have years to live. If you'd be in my shoes, where would you be?" And she looks at the clown, and the clown looks at her. And they laugh. What are they supposed to do, right? She told me the story. She told me the story laughing. So here you have a person that comes home every night, sees her children, knows she doesn't have 6 months to see them, but chooses to smile in the face of death. That's a choice every person makes. I remember I accompanied them once to visit a top specialist in Tel Aviv, and I got all carsick, so they had to stop a few times along the way, and I go out and I vomit, and we continue going, and I come in there, and I wonder, you know, this guy's office, every marble tile on the floor, you know you're paying for it, 10,000-15,000 shekel each tile you step on, and I'm walking in there after throwing up 4 or 5 times along the road. I wasn't too happy about that, but okay, I'm sitting there in this fancy top building there in Tel Aviv, and trying to contain myself not to throw up on him. But we finished the meeting, and we have to travel back to Yerushalayim. So we start driving, and she tells her husband, "Could we stop by the sea?" So I said, "Look, I'm really sorry, but I can't handle this prolonged journey." And I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's not nice of me, but I'm throwing up the whole ride. I'm a person too. And I'm kicking myself, you know. Here she is, she wants to see the sea, and then she says, "No, it's not a problem, it's not a big deal. I just wanted to do one thing at the sea." So I'm sitting there in suspense, "What you want to do?" She said, "I want to make one more bracha on the sea." And then I really kicked myself. Okay, so that's a person who says, "Okay, I don't have an answer." She didn't have answers. But I have to deal with the life I have, and I have a choice between the stimuli and the response. That's where I'm defined. And you know what? He walked out of that class with a smile, and he decided, and I don't know how long he was able to stick, till he left the country. He called me up when he left the country, and he said he had to go back to have more surgery done, and ever since then we haven't gotten through to him on email or phones. I don't know what's doing with him, but that was his decision, and he stuck by it for the next month, all the procedures he went through. And that's a choice a person has, and a responsibility a person has. So that's, I think, part of the do's and don'ts. Obviously, there's more to be said. There's a whole discussion of pain in the world, and the Medrash about all the years that Rebbe was in pain, no woman miscarried, that no pain goes unwasted, so to speak. And there's much more to be said about tzaddikim and gilgulim and neshamos, but these are attitudes, more so than if you'd ask me... And I very much buy what Tzion said earlier. Nachmanides makes that argument there, Hagav Tzion, that don't give me claims you can't prove. Nachmanides, when he talks to the Christians, he says, "Well, you could just say anything if you're talking that way." That's why I don't like talking about Gilgulim. But if you're going to talk about Gilgulim in the sense, Gilgulim, by the way, is reincarnation, the idea that a soul keeps coming back. If you're going to talk about it in terms of giving an ill patient, giving them the strength to contend, or some kind of answer which they can live with, that I can handle. In a philosophy class, I can't deal with it. In a practical, how am I going to deal with life class? Okay, so that's a solution sometimes. You don't know, you probably, you know, like we say, I just got a phone call from someone who lost her 7th or 8th child. Every child she can't hold in and miscarries. And her main question is always... tell me that there's a concept of Gilgulim, that these are souls that just needed to come through a Jewish mother and finish their course. And okay, that's good for 100%. There are Gilgulim for the last 14 years. I've been telling her there are Gilgulim, and that's what's going on. And that's what keeps her going. Okay, fine. Therapeutic it is. Philosophical, I can't deal. Okay.
But Rav, on that, there are sources.